I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Who was the first internet troll?
What does the word meme mimic?
And what language does the word Jedi come from?
We're getting technological and a little science fictional as we spam you with the etymology of the internet, cyborgs, and the digital verse. Log on, it's time for another episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Safaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And let's get digital. We are exploring technology and sci-fi and internet-themed words on this episode.
Yeah, words from the internet age and from the many worlds of science fiction. This is going to be an even more geeky one than usual, Jess.
I think so. Though we've already done AI-themed topics before, but I think this one's a little more celebratory because we both poo-pooed AI a little bit.
Yeah, indeed. So where should we start when we're talking about tech and the internet age?
I think we should start with the word technology, which is a very, very old word and meant almost the opposite of what it does now. Not exactly the opposite, but certainly a different meaning. A Greek technologia was a discourse or treatise on the arts, and the root here means to weave or fabricate things that are made. And then we get to mechanical and industrial arts in the 1700s. A 1787 political survey of Europe, for example, described technology as a new branch of scientific knowledge involving the theory and accurate description of useful arts and manufactures.
That's our technology covered. Let's zone in on some bits of technology. We're talking about the internet. Do you have some internet-y words at your disposal?
I have the word internet.
Oh, that'll do. Yes, let's go with that one.
It's not much of a revelation, but the progress of its development is interesting. The earliest known use of this word is actually in a past participle form. Interneted meant connected or interwoven as early as the 1800s. And then the tech sense of internet was first used in 1945 when the War Department in the US used it as a shorthand for internetwork in a radio operator manual. So a small interconnected network. And then a network, of course, is a system that is shaped either physically or figuratively like a net, with a network dating back to the 1500s and like spider webs described as networks. And nets and artistic elements and things. And today, an internet can still be a smaller network, but it's also the capital I global internet as well.
And we talk about intranets as well. Although that's kind of interesting, because what you said there is that internet is a kind of a portmanteau sort of contraction rather than it actually having the etymology that its elements suggest, which would be like across networks, right? Whereas the intranet does effectively have that etymology, right? Because
between.
The intra means within something. Intranet is more etymologically pure, if it's possible to be such a thing, than the word internet.
It was, I mentioned a minute ago, capital I internet, but that's actually not a thing anymore. That's kind of a 10-year-old thing. Even the AP style book ditched that in 2016. So it's been a decade since we stopped capitalizing internet formally.
There are a lot of things like email that originally had a capital letter that we don't use anymore. But there was such a rebellion against that idea that we started, for some reason, putting the capital letter as the second letter of a word. And so we ended up with various E prefix thing or I prefix thing, of course, anything that came out of the Apple Corporation. It's more of a subject than you might think, isn't it? The capitalization of techie words.
It is a recurring theme in at least the last 200 years or so to take a word, coin it, capitalize it, and then let it fade into normalcy and therefore become uncapitalized.
It's almost a badge of honor if your brand name becomes lowercase, but at the same time, it's probably quite irritating, isn't it? You know, for example, that in Britain, we call a vacuum cleaner a Hoover, named after a specific brand of vacuum cleaner. That's great for the Hoover Corporation or whatever they were called. You know, they're so ubiquitous that their name becomes the word for the thing. But also it means at the same time they get zero credit, right? If other people's products are also being called Hoovers.
They call that trademark death or something like that and that happened with things like Zipper and maybe not Velcro quite yet, but Band-Aids, things like that. Jacuzzi. And windbreaker, TV dinner.
Can I talk about a word that I can't see how we'll get to it more organically? So I'm just going to sort of throw it in. But it's the word data. People watching this will notice that I'm in different environs to usual. That's because I'm at my in-law's place in France. And we were talking about something too boring for me to tell you about. But just during the course of it, the French word for data came up. The French word for data is donné, which literally means givens, things given. I thought, oh, that's a weird way to approach the idea of data. No, it's not. No, it's not. The etymology of the word data or datum, a datum is a thing given.
Huh.
It means exactly the same as the French word donné. So the idea that data is actually the things that you give to something. So actually, it's come really full circle, the concept, because one thing we think of data as now is information that we have given to some corporation that is now taking control of and is supposed to be looking after it for us, but now we worry about whether or not it does. Whereas, you know, previously data has just meant any sort of input, but really, really does feel like it's something you've given nowadays.
It is related to the word date. So I was assuming maybe it had something to do with time, but date just means a given time. And then it's data is related to words like anecdote and dowry and donor and things like that, which is endow. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, donor is related to that French word donner, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
The French verb for to give. We can't talk about data, by the way, without talking about the, you know, the whole plural singular thing.
Datum.
The fact that data is technically, etymologically, is the plural, but is clearly the singular now. I mean,
right.
Used like that. You know, I was looking this up and I found a quote, someone complaining about data being used incorrectly from as far back as the 1940s. So we shouldn't get too worried about it. 1949 in the journal Nature. Data was a plural noun. For literate English writers, it still is. And I contend that it always should be.
One of my favorite creators to follow is Paul Ferry, and he assembles newspaper clippings of people complaining about things over the centuries. So like short skirts blamed for blank, short skirts blamed for this, children outdoors blamed for this, dating back like hundreds of years. It's fantastic.
And it's amazing how there are complaints that people will lodge particularly grammatical ones or relating to word usage that seem very modern. It's like, oh, I really hate the way people are using literally wrong or whatever. Yeah. And you do find the same complaints from before the person who was complaining was born, before their grandparents were born sometimes.
Jane Austen's novels contain jokes about people misusing figuratively and literally.
Doesn't surprise me one bit. Speaking of bits, can I move on to volumes of data, which I just briefly wanted to look up, because I think, okay, so we've got the gigabyte. We know about the terabyte. People perhaps know about the petabyte. Where does it go after that as like our capacity to store data increases? And I was looking these up, and after peta, you have exa, exabyte. So the exabyte is 1,000 petabytes. Then you've got zettabytes, which is 1,000 exabytes, and yotta bytes, which is 1,000 zettabytes. And I was thinking, why, where do zeta and yotta come from? Because my knowledge of the classic languages isn't extraordinary, but I do know that those are not related to any of their numbers. Do you know about this, Jess? Because this is really extraordinary how they came up with these names.
What I know is that a byte, at least originally, was 8 bits, and then bit was chosen because it's a combination. It's sort of a portmanteau of binary digit. So maybe something to do with that, but you're well past where I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, once we're getting into the zeta and yotta. So the zeta and yotta were officially accepted as the where we're going next with these big numbers in the 90s. But the reason that they are zeta and yotta are not what you would expect them to be based upon, so they're related to the Latin roots for 7 and 8, right?
Because we're not looking at Greek letters.
No, yeah, very good point. Yeah, because you've got obviously got zeta, which is a Greek letter. No, zeta is a deliberate bastardization of septa. And yotta is a deliberate bastardization of octo or octo. And the reason that they've been changed to these other things is that they realized that if you had S as the abbreviation for septa, then it would look like seconds. Because they're not just looking at using these prefixes for data, they're looking at using them for very large periods of time as well. So that's why they put zeta bytes or zeta as the prefix, because the Z is not going to interfere with the S that you have as the abbreviation of other units. And they also came up with the zepto prefix and yocto prefix. So whereas zeta is 10 to the power 21, zepto is 10 to the power minus 21. So really, really small. And then whereas yotta is 10 to the power 24, yocto is 10 to the minus 24. And they're obviously not concerned about confusing these Zs and the Ys on those, just because they're talking about such different magnitudes, you know, in complete opposite directions. But I thought that was a weirdly arbitrary way to come up with these words that up until this point, so generally, you know, divisions of 1,000, if you're dividing something up, you're using Latin words. And if you're multiplying it, you're using Greek words. But they've pretty reliable, and they're, you know, they're pretty true to those original classical words. But after we've reached a certain point, we've gone, okay, now we've actually got to start making up words for the prefixes for these vast digits, these vast values that we're getting into that humans were never supposed to get into. We were never supposed to get to 10 to the minus 24 of anything. Come on.
It also occurs to me with the Z versus S that an S could look like a 5 in a digital format. So perhaps something good to be said there.
Yes. That's the only way that boobies works, isn't it?
That's true.
It's true, yes. What I've just said is scientific.
Yes, indeed. Well, on that note,
where are you going to go on that note?
I don't know. I don't know where I'm going to go on that note. But what about
cyber boobies? Can we talk about like?
I was going to talk about the word cyber. That's what I had next. So cyber is from the word cybernetics. Every use of the piece cyber that gets tacked onto a different word is from cybernetics. But it is a rebracketing that steals a letter, because the Greek root here is kybernetis, which means steersman, and the N belongs with the Khyber bit, that the like edics is the ending, not netics. Presumably that is due to a folk etymology assumption that the netics bit is related to the word net as in internet, but it's just a part of this Greek word that became cybernetics. And the root of that word is meant to imply guiding or governing things, and it is also likely partially inspired by a French term used famously by physicist and mathematician André-Marie Ampère, whose name came to inspire amps and amperage, and he wrote that the future science of government should be called cybernétique, the study of governing things. But anyway, as a prefix, cyber got added to pretty much anything in the 90s to indicate a relation to the internet. It's almost old-fashioned sounding now. It's like cyber snob, cyber friend, cyberpunk, cyber feminist, things like that. There was a 1996 article in New York Magazine that said, cyber is such a perfect prefix because nobody has any idea what it means. It could be grafted onto any old word to make it seem new, cool, and therefore strange and spooky.
An interesting offshoot of cyber is the word cyborg, which is actually a contraction of cybernetic organism. I was trying to work out, is that technically a portmanteau or is it not? Because if it was a portmanteau, would it need to be cybernism?
Cyborgism.
Exactly. But yeah, it means cybernetic organism. And I the word's first citation is actually from 1960 in the New York Times. A cyborg is essentially a man-machine system in which the control mechanisms of the human portion are modified externally by drugs or regulatory devices so that the being can live in an environment different from the normal one.
Astronauts. Like, the context was we were talking about things that keep people alive in space, which has lent it some, like, sci-fi cred, even though it was hard sci.
And then you get things being referred to as Borgs as well, don't you? Which is...
Right. Which is
again a bit of rebracketing.
Yeah.
While we're talking about sort of humanoids, we should talk about android, robot. Those are both really interesting words with really interesting stories. Would you like to take one of them?
The word robot more or less means slave, right?
Absolutely, it does mean slave, and it has meant slave in Czech. Robota.
It first appeared in English in a 1923 translation of the 1920 Czech play RUR, which stood for Rossum's Universal Robots. And it refers to Robotnik means forced worker, originally from an old Slavonic word for slave, which, speaking of Slavonic and the word slave, that's also an interesting connection there that I think we've addressed before.
Yeah. It's a tricky one, that.
But the play was by Karl Čapek, and though it was his brother Joseph who came up with the term, and the robots in the play are androids, essentially, sort of like what you see in Westworld. They got meat. But before that, robots were called automatons, right? Automaton was a broader word than robot, referring to any supposedly self-operating machine, but it was famously associated with, like, automatons from Greek mythology, and then later with, like, the Mechanical Turk, an automaton chess player, also called the Turk, that was first displayed in 1770 and could play chess supposedly autonomously, but apparently not.
Yeah, I mean, there are various tales from down the centuries of people who supposedly created human-like machines that can perform, I mean, stuff that even AI can't do now, right? And I think it's fair to say that we're sort of at the moment we are peaking at our abilities to replicate human behavior with machines. Actually, you mentioned that it was Karol Čapek's brother who came up with the idea of using that Czech word for these slaves. Not mechanical, actually. Yeah, they're organic, aren't they? Basically, but what Karol actually wanted to call them before that was laborers.
Oh,
his original idea was to use the Latin for work for their name. So we might be calling robots laborers rather than automatons, as we were calling them before, if his word for what he called his man machines was destined to become our word for an android. Hmm. Yeah, it would have been laborers. Oh, hey, hold on. Android.
Yes.
Okay. So we talked about Borgs being a rebracketing, but android as well gave us the word droid.
Yes.
Didn't it?
It sure did.
Kind of interesting. Can I talk about the history of the word android?
Yeah, let's do that.
Because it's also, again, it's weirdly specific, you know. So the word was first used to describe, it's a bit confusing, but it was first used in the 1600s by a French guy called Gabriel Naudet, who was actually the personal doctor to Louis XIII. But he was a theologian, very rational guy, right? And he was talking about the story of a guy called Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great, right? And legend had it that Albert had somehow managed to create out of metal, out of bronze and other metals, a human that could talk.
Ooh.
And that he'd created, some stories say he just created the head. Some say he created the whole thing. It could do various things like offer him sage advice. It could even potentially have dictated some of his writings. And so when it comes to writing about it, Gabriel Naudé uses the word android, the French word android, to describe this human, well, this metallic human that Albert the Great supposedly created. However, he is using the term pejoratively, and he's using it as he dismantles the idea, because it's obviously nonsense that this guy created out of metal something that could form human noises. And it's so, we're so darn complicated, like our vocal tract and our tongues and all of this stuff going on. I mean, it's really, really hard to replicate human sound mechanically without using human bits and bobs, which is not what Magnus the Great did. But anyway, that use of the word android specifically to describe Albertus Magnus's spooky talking head.
And
is
it
the
just
origin
means
of the word android.
Man-shaped, right?
It means man-shaped. Yeah, we talked about that oid suffix before, so at the end of a lot of things. When you see oid, you know that something is shaped like the thing that comes before the oid, not necessarily is it.
We see that frequently in humanoid. We are humanoid because we are human-shaped. We are also humans, but you can also be human-shaped from Tatooine or something like that and not be an ape-descended life form from Earth.
But oid is just a really good sci-fi sounding ending to a word as well.
I mean, so asteroid, I think, did a lot for us. Yeah, absolutely.
Asteroid, star-shaped, although ultimately they're not.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Should we move on to meme?
Oh, meme. Yeah, meme's a good one. You know what I like about us doing this tech subject? Mm-hmm. There are words here where we know precisely when they were coined. And we can even read the words of the people who coined them. I mean, I just mentioned, you know, the Android one, but meme is an even better one because it's coined in a book written within the last half century or about a half century ago. When was it written? Hold on.
Don't do that to me. It's 1976.
1976. Very good. Okay. So I was right. Just within the last half century. The book, of course, is Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene.
Only 25 years ago.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it's bad, Jess. It's bad. It's ages ago. Sorry. I couldn't believe it.
Anyway,
I honestly couldn't believe
gene.
It. Yeah. So, and he coins, well, he uses the word meme to mean an idea that spreads, obviously, not a photo of a jealous girlfriend. You know, it has obviously come to mean that. But he was very specific about why he had chosen that word as well. Can I read the quote? Is that okay?
Please.
He says, we need a name for the new replicator. So the whole point, right, is that memes are like genes. He's trying to make this point, and that they spread like genetics. You know, we need a name for this new replicator, a noun that conveys the idea of a unit of cultural transmission, of a unit of imitation. Mimeme comes from a suitable Greek root. So the word he's talking about there is the one that gives us words like mime and mimic. But I want a monosyllable that sounds a bit like gene. I hope my classicist friends will forgive me if I abbreviate mimeme to meme. If it is any consolation, it could alternatively be thought of as being related to memory or to the French word mem, which means the same. But he's, you know, he's just saying that it looks like those. It's not related to those. What he also says, and this is important, because I remember in the early days of internet memes, people pronouncing it like meme and stuff like that. He does say in this book from 1976, so people have plenty of time to check, it should be pronounced to rhyme with cream. There you go. Examples of memes are tunes, ideas, catchphrases, clothes, fashions, ways of making pots or of building arches. So the point is, it's any idea, and he absolutely is not thinking about the internet that as yet does not exist when he coins that term.
He also described God or any God from any religion as an ancient meme, a shared character, figure, or idea that appears many times and with many variations throughout history as people attempt to rationalize their purpose and the source of their existence, which I think is neat. This book ultimately gave us the whole field of memetics, which is like genetics, which seeks to explain how ideas propagate, which is cool.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, people aren't aware of Richard Dawkins. He's very much not a God guy, right? Yeah. So his other most famous book is called The God Delusion. So him nevertheless applying this term to God or gods themselves is significant.
Anytime that I have talked about this word and its source before, I've had a lot of people respond with a lot of Dawkins hate and from both sides of the religious spectrum.
Yeah, it's funny, yeah, because people who agree with him, he tends to rub them up the wrong way as well. It's kind of interesting.
Like, I'm just here for the word origin.
Do we need to go there? Because this word is everywhere now. It's astonishing. It's in around 1998 that it takes hold as being used to refer to bits and bobs that are sent around on the internet. There's a quotation from 1998. The next thing you know, his friends have forwarded, what he's talking about, by the way, an animation of a dancing baby. It says, the next thing you know, his friends have forwarded it on and it's become a net meme. What's interesting there is the use of the word net before it. And you find that a lot of the early usages of the word do have the word internet, web, net in front of them, because you do have to specify that a meme, you know, is not exclusively an online phenomenon. It basically is now. You'd really struggle to use it outside of that context without people thinking you meant something from the internet. Though, of course, you still could.
I think it's interesting that net meme was used in that context, because nowadays I think people would say the full word internet meme. And I wonder, I have noticed that in the past, when you read discourse about the internet from a couple decades ago, people tended to use net a little bit more, like on the net and whatnot. But internet seems more common now. So I wonder why we cycled back.
You know, this is a funny thing to watch, like during your lifetime, words become passé and net is very much one of those.
Same with cyber, right?
Yeah.
We still get like cyber criminals and things like that. And cyber technology in general is still a word used in many cases, but it's not used as colloquially as it was a couple decades ago.
No, you wouldn't dream of setting up a brand with cyber or net in the name now. It would immediately seem fusty.
Calling someone a cyber friend would be a little cringe.
Friends. Yeah. Actually, this reminds me of chat rooms.
Yes.
Net chat rooms, right? Which have spawned various terms that have really caught on, you know. One of which is spam.
Yes. Spam, spam, spam.
Spam, 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 spam.
Which is the source of it, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Anyone who doesn't know, there's the Monty Python sketch where for reasons that are not explained, there is a cafe, an English cafe, a greasy spoon, as we would call it, serves, you know, food. Technically, it's food. but this particular one is populated mostly by Vikings who will interrupt your conversation with a chant of spam, 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 spamity spam, wonderful spam. And yeah, that's where this idea of spam comes from. It is a reference to that sketch and the way that it sort of drowns out everything else. But what I think is quite interesting is the reputable sources all say that that is where spam in the sort of email sense comes from. Even though from as early as the 1940s, you do have the word spam being used to refer to stuff that's, you know, pointless or getting in the way, or a waste of time.
Low quality mixed meats.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, we should actually mention the etymology of spam itself. It's spiced ham. Actually, the product was called Hormel's Spiced Ham. Then they held a competition to find a new name for it. And it was a gentleman from New York, an actor called Kenneth Daniot. I don't know if it's Daniot. I mean, if he pronounces it like a French name, it's Daniot, but he might have called himself Dagnew or something like that. Yeah, and he suggested spam.
He won $100 for it.
He did.
That seems like not enough. Lifetime spam.
I think there's a lot more money in those days, and spam was very, very cheap. But I got us into this discussion of spam, talking about chat rooms and the like, and forums. And that's because it was a spam message sent to a Usenet group that is often said to have been the first instance of spam. It was accidentally sent by Richard Depew, who's a software developer, on March the 31st, 1993. He accidentally sent the same message 200 times. And yeah, one user said that it was email spam. And yeah, from there, we probably, you know, the word takes hold. These Usenet forums, what were they called? I didn't use them myself. It's actually just slightly before my time. So I'm sorry if I'm getting the nomenclature wrong with the Usenet stuff.
I was an AIM messenger kid, so I can't help.
Yeah, that's it. I was an MSN messenger, yeah. BRB. Yeah. You know, in 2004, Bill Gates said that spam would be eradicated within 2 years.
Oh, that's cute. Hold on. One of the things that we brought up on the Word of the Year episode of Grammar Girls podcast.
Ah, which I did watch. It was very good.
It was fun. I won't get into it too far. And this is the only AI thing that I will really address. But spam has the same energy as AI slop, this low quality mass produced AI output that accompanied the first wave of accessible inner conversational AI tools and image generators. And one of the things that we mentioned is that slop spawned a lot of portmanteaus, since we keep bringing these up, but I really like them, like sloptimism, which is AI optimism, yeah. So usually used in a mocking way, sloppertunism, sloppaganda, and slopperators.
Sloppaganda is beautiful.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, all of these must have been coined within the last sort of 18 months or something like that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the slop must flow.
Yeah. I mean, there was always slop before that. I mean, there's always been like PR slop. This slop word has really, really taken off. It's amazing how it is that very specific term, slop, that has been, for some reason, just captures the sense of it being, you know, worthless, a little bit sort of dirty feeling. I just want to mention one more thing, though, about these Usenet forums, because were they forums?
That sounds right. Servers.
Sounds right.
Servers.
Yeah.
Usenet server is the phrase that I typically hear. But again, I am wrong era for me.
So Usenet is also the source of the word troll. There is an original troll.
Ooh, tell me.
There was an original user on Usenet who called themselves troll and would patrol the forums, the news group, trying to incite people into arguments.
So they were trolling like a ship trolls.
Yeah, exactly.
But also like a bridge troll.
Like a bridge troll. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not actually related to like the word patrol. They see me rolling, me trolling. So 1992 this is a group about something called flaming and counter-flaming. I don't know what that is. Sorry.
Insulting.
Right, okay.
And aggressing.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
Insulting and aggressive behavior, pestering, things like that.
So in the context of that, this is what Troll wrote on the Usenet newsgroup. You wouldn't know a good flame or counterflame if it leaped up through the swiveling chairs you're sitting on and scorched your lardsome asses.
Right. That is a good insult. That is a good insult.
Yeah, it is good. Straight from the mouth or the fingertips of the original troll. And so certainly on the Usenet forums, this idea of a troll gets transplanted from this individual user more broadly. obviously that is from the early 90s. And I think most of us would say that the word troll in the sense that we now use it emerged much later than that, don't you think? I mean, it feels like more of a social media thing, doesn't it? When you have people deliberately. And I think there's really two sort of births of the word. You do have that one attributed to Usenet, which gives you a very early example of someone literally being a troll and trying to draw people into arguments, which is the earliest use, which is, you know, the original sort of sense on the internet is that a troll is someone who's deliberately trying to rile people up. I mean, nowadays, I think trolls just used to describe anyone who does anything that someone doesn't like on the internet.
Yeah. Any bad faith behavior.
Yeah, you put it better than I did. Yeah, bad faith behavior.
My Reddit username kind of sounds like a troll username. And so I am often, like, if I am engaging in those spaces, sometimes people think that I'm being nasty when I'm not.
You got to tell us what it is, Jess.
No, I can't. I can't. I absolutely cannot. No, I cannot. That's not something we can do.
Okay. No one can say I didn't try. Okay.
Honestly, someone's going to find it in like 10 minutes because it's like not also, it's not even that secret. And I haven't done anything scandalous over there either. So. I would like to go to the word meta as we use it today, because the way we use meta today is partially based on an error of interpretation. When you stick the Greek-derived suffix meta onto another word, it often means beyond or transcending, but meta in Greek did not mean beyond. Like, that's so meta or metaphysics, like, we'll get there. Meta in Greek could mean in the midst of, by means of, in pursuit of, between, after, or behind, but not usually beyond, which is kind of how we use it today. You might say that after is pretty close to beyond, and you'd be right, but they don't mean the same thing, and here's why that's important. Between the 3rd and 5th centuries BCE, Greek scholars arranged Aristotle's works into collections. One of them is called the Physics. It addresses physics and natural sciences. Another one covers a range of abstract topics, including the essence of being and the immaterial and immaterial existence. That collection is called the Metaphysics, or Metaphysica, and that title inspired the name of the whole field of metaphysics. And metaphysics comes from the Greek name given to the collection, ta meta ta physica. Because the collection dealt with abstract topics, the Greek term was understood by Latin scholars to mean the science of what is beyond the physical, but that's not what it meant. The Greek title, ta meta ta physica, literally just means that which comes after the physics. The collection's title wasn't referring to its contents, but its sequence of publication. The Greek title, meta, meant after, not beyond. So let's see why that's important. So the misinterpretation of the Greek title infused the word-forming element meta with the sense of beyond or transcending or dealing with the most fundamental aspects of things. And it's this meaning that also appears in words like metacommunications, metahistory, and metaverse. And of course, the longstanding adjective meta, as in that's so meta, I guess not a lot longstanding, but standalone. This, I think, just goes to show that even these bright disciplines can end up running with folk etymology.
Metaverse is a word that I struggle to think of another word that seemed at one point so futuristic and now seems so in the past. Like, the metaverse was the future. And within touching distance, I made a whole video about it for the international broadcaster I was working for. And just, you know, I went into this special lab where they took loads of photos of me from different angles, and I got to wander around the metaverse. And there's a wow, this is it. This is, let's all put our money into metaverses because that's where it's all going. And then ChatGPT is all gone. It's all gone.
I mean, the concept still exists, like virtual spaces and interactions still exist. So like elements of what they called the metaverse are still a thing. It's just we don't need a word for it because they're kind of ubiquitous elements of gaming spaces and things like that. I always thought it was silly that we needed like the metaverse. It's like, well, yeah, Roblox has a metaverse and so does World of Warcraft, you know?
I mean, we tend to just call those universes as well, don't we? We just say it's You think how Facebook was so dedicated to the idea of the metaverse that they changed their name to Meta.
Yeah, now Metaverse feels like whatever spaces exist on platforms that Facebook owns. Like,
I mean, that's that kind of is it, isn't it? They've taken full ownership of it. And that was very much their intention, was to take ownership of that term because it was going to be the future. But I mean, maybe it still is going to be the future, but it doesn't feel like it right now, does it?
Speaking of verse and universe, I do think this is kind of neat outside of, you know, the specialized context of poetry and music. The verse is a back formation of universe, right? Which is made up of Latin elements meaning turned into one. So verse literally means turn, but over time it has become a word forming element meaning world or realm. And you can stick it onto other words to give like fictional universes like Buffyverse or Hooniverse or Duneverse. And according to the book Brave New Worlds, the Oxford Dictionary of Science Fiction, verse was first used in this way by Orson Scott Card, who referred to the Ender's Game universe as the Enderverse. But I would argue that that usage of verse is older than that, because philosopher William James coined the term multiverse, yes, as far back as the 1890s.
And a lot of those are, again, examples of rebracketing, aren't they? Because when they've put the iverse on the end of something, that is a rebracketing, because it should be verse as the final element. I say should be. I mean, does it matter? No. Because no one's actually trying to invoke the idea of turning when they right. use that suffix anymore. So it doesn't really matter. You kind of just touched on words from science fiction there, but let's talk about some more. Because there are actually words that get created for science fiction that have got quite interesting etymologies. You know what? I'm really interested. So I will say, I don't spend any of my time watching, reading science fiction. I'm nothing against it. I read and watch other things. I think probably if I did get into it, I would really enjoy it. They're obviously there's some marvelous storytellers involved in these things, so it must be great. But I am aware of Star Wars. I'm aware of a few of the words
which is not
that are in
science
there.
Fiction. It is a space opera.
Yeah, okay. Right.
it's also a Western cowboy wizard space story.
it's sort of a space costume drama as well. I mean, because obviously it's set in the past, right? Which is the strange thing. And it is the choice of words that are inspired by classical languages and old languages that I think makes Star Wars seem ancient, like the places and the people involved.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful world building. That's why everybody enjoys it, whether like depending on... There's a lot of discourse. I'm not going to anger any Star Wars fans. I just got finished rewatching the first two trilogies, and I have a dog named Obi. So after Obi-Wan Kenobi. So I am a fan, but I'm also, you know, I think people get really invested in it because it's such an easy universe to insert yourself into.
Mm, it's all very well thought through. When it comes to sort of the languages that are involved, there are words inspired by Hebrew. I think one of the theories is that Yoda actually is a Hebrew word, Yodha, although I'm not sure if that's actually true. That's one of the theories floating around.
That was intentional.
Well, quite easily, George Lucas could just go through all of these theories and say, yes, that one's right, that one's wrong. It hasn't happened yet. And Yoda's one of them. But Yoda's name wasn't originally Yoda. It was Minch Yoda. And he was a kind of sort of little wise toad, frog sort of character. But what Lucas has been quoted as saying about that character is that the name Yoda was chosen because he envisioned a character that was a bit like the Dalai Lama, and so he wanted an Eastern sounding name, which I think is kind of interesting. So that would not suggest that he would have taken the Hebrew word, I don't think. I mean, obviously Hebrew is Eastern, but it's not that sort of Eastern. But when we're talking about much further east, the word Jedi very much does come from Southeast Asia. It's from Japanese. So the Jedi were originally in the very first form. I sound like I know what I'm talking about here. I've only just researched the words here. I don't really know what I'm talking about when it comes to the actual canon. But Jedi, the first Jedi that Lucas wrote about were called the Jedi Bendu. And they were based entirely on samurai, right? They're basically samurai. And there is a genre in Japan called Jidai Geki, right? And Jidai Geki basically means period drama. And it's from Jidai Geki, obviously, that we get the word Jedi. And they are, to start with, you know, sort of a protectorate. They're protectors of the emperor, very much like a samurai. So that's where the word Jedi comes from. They are samurai. And then there's this other thing. And then we'll get away from Star Wars, promise.
We don't have to.
So Darth Vader, right? Darth Vader.
Ah, I love this one. I know this one.
It has to mean dark dad, right? It has to mean
But
that.
It doesn't. I mean, like, that's...
But he says it doesn't.
No.
And how... So, Vader is literally the Dutch for father.
I know. Right? It's so funny. But it's so you have Darth Sidious and Darth Vader, Darth Insidious, Darth Invader. Like, that's the logic.
Is that it? Is that really it?
That is what I've read before. I'm going to need to... I don't have this in front of me. And so fact checking, but this is what I've read before, is that the intention wasn't Dark Daddy.
Yeah, I think I buy it, because he does seem to stumble across these things. A bit like the Yoda one, right? The Yoda, the idea that it's from Hebrew Yoda falls apart when you realize that his name wasn't originally Yoda.
Also, you know, when he named Vader, he didn't have the plan for him to be Luke's father yet.
Is that true?
I mean, it looks like a big spoiler to anyone who speaks a Germanic language.
That is what I was thinking. The Dutch know. All the Dutch, they already know.
And again, I am remembering this from an earlier conversation, an earlier batch of research. So please, by all means, check me, my dear sci-fi and Star Wars nerds.
Jess, can you give us some words that we use that are originally from science fiction?
This is debatably science fiction. I would say this is more a vestige of comics, but it has a science fiction edge to it. So, you know, in comics, we have illustrated onomatopoeia, like bam, pow, zap, those things like that. The word zap wasn't a word that people used for zapping things until Buck Rogers in the 25th century used it as an illustrated onomatopoeia. This dates back to the early 20th century, and historians often credit Roy Crane, who was the creator of Wash Tubs in the 1920s, as being one of the first cartoonists to create bold sound effects in his panels. Like, he would letter gunshots and crashes and punches into the artwork. And these effects became core to the comic book medium. And so there were conventions, like we see boom a lot, and the way it's illustrated is similar across most, but we also get slash and zip and things like that, that were stretched into streaks and things. But zap was popularized as like a ray gun, basically, from sci-fi comics, which I think is really fun. It just was not popularized as a word for electrocution or other related effects until that was illustrated in that way.
And now it's a verb, right? You can zap something. Yes. You can get zapped.
Another fun, speaking of zapping, I believe I have addressed Taser before, so I won't go into it that far, but it means Tom A. Swift's electric rifle. And the rifle is a fictional weapon wielded by the character Tom Swift, who made his novel debut in 1910. Also, because every time I mention Tom Swift, somebody's like, talk about Tom Swifties. I do think I would like to very briefly mention what a Tom Swiftie is. Do you know what a Tom Swiftie is?
I know what a Swiftie is. tell me what a Tom Swiftie is.
A Tom Swiftie is a phrase in which a quoted sentence works with the attribution in prose to create a pun in the attribution. So, I'd like my money back and then some, said Tom with interest. Don't ask me why I was at the mausoleum, Tom said cryptically. We're out of flowers, said Tom lackadaisically.
Oh yeah, I like these. I like these.
Right? I also like, I forgot what I needed at the store, Tom said listlessly. Or get to the back of the ship, Tom said sternly.
Oh, I love these. Oh, these just show up my street.
Some of the Tom Swift books are really fun to read. So I would recommend that. It's... goofy silliness. And they were a particular recurring trope in that series with that character.
Well, Jess, I for one am feeling a bit zapped. are we done with this
he
episode?
He said electrically.
Very good, Jess. I do like those. I'm going to look up more of those. That's a rich vein. I really enjoyed this exploration of terms from science fiction and the internet age.
It's time to bring this episode to an end, she said conclusively. And we'll see you next time.
And just before we go, can I just say something? I just want to plug a thing. I've never had an opportunity to plug something like this before. Yeah. But I'm doing a live show, as in a live in-person on a stage show, April the 11th at London's Bloomsbury Theatre. So you kind of need to be the right side of the Atlantic to go. Although, I mean, you're welcome to cross it if you're feeling particularly like you want to come and see this in person. But
I plan to.
Oh, man, it'd be so exciting if you came over. I really hope you can make it. So you might get to see Jess there as well. Although I can't promise that. That is not included in the ticket price is presence of Jess Zafaris. But I'll leave a link below if you would like to get tickets for you and a wordy, nerdy pal to come along. April the 11th, Bloomsbury Theatre, London. See you there. Thank you for letting me do that, Jess.
Oh, I'm so excited. I can't wait to see it.